Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Happy Thursday, June 1st, or maybe Friday, June 2nd, depending on where you are around the world. We're awful glad you're here. Thanks for being here with us. It's an open forum today, but it's an internet open forum. All of our questions will come from the internet, and Jimmy Akin here to answer them. And this is a very special day for Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, the author of a whole bunch of different things. Jimmy Akin, today, celebrating his anniversary of coming here to Catholic Answers. Congratulations on this big day, Jimmy.
Thank you. Yeah, my report to work date was, by coincidence, this wasn't designed, but was June 1st, the feast of St. Justin Martyr, patron of apologists, which I've always viewed as providential. And it was June 1st of 1993. So since it's now 2023, that means I've been doing this for 30 years.
That is amazing. And the radio show turned 25 at the beginning of this year. So several the first years, no radio show. But did you do media like this? Like maybe it was recorded talks and stuff? Or how did your
Well, initially I did a lot of correspondence.
Okay.
Because this was before the internet. And so the way that people had to, the ways that people primarily had to reach us were by letter and by phone call.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would answer a lot of people's questions by letter and by phone call. Eventually, we got the internet because that came out, and we were an early adopter, so we got Catholic.com.
Mm-hmm.
We also started the radio show after a few years. There was also public speaking, and there were you know, occasional radio interviews and things like that, but we didn't have a regular radio show until we started Catholic Answers Live.
Are you our longest serving employee now, or is Jen Phelps?
Oh,
you're
nope.
Jen
she
Phelps came
after me.
You.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, congratulations, Jimmy. 30 years. I mean, you must have been an apologist before you came here, but 30 years as a public apologist with Catholic Answers.
Yes. Yeah. And I did have training in apologetics before I came to Catholic Answers. My academic background is in philosophy, and one of the philosophical subjects I focused on was philosophy of religion. And so that involved apologetics. Also, I took a lot of medieval philosophy, so that exposed me to a lot of Catholic theology. I also studied epistemology and metaphysics and things like that. But I had also self-training in apologetics, including because of the fact I became Catholic. You know, I had been on a ministerial track in the Protestant community, but I admit being the theologies of all different branches of Christendom. And eventually I concluded I need to give Catholicism a closer look. But by that point, I had years of, you know, theological training in Protestant thought. And so I had to review all of the categories of systematic theology with an open mind to the Catholic position and fight through the arguments, you know, which understanding of this area is better. And so I had a lot of arguments to unlearn, and that process of conversion therefore led to me gaining a background in specifically Catholic apologetics.
It's funny when you say yourself taught in many ways, because there wasn't a field of apologetics in those days. I mean, there wasn't, like now people, if you say to someone, I want to be an apologist, people have an image. It's you, it's Jimmy, it's Pat Madrid, you know, I suppose maybe you looked back to, Frank Sheed maybe, or Chesterton.
No.
I don't know. No,
no.
None of that.
No. I mean, I knew who Frank Sheed and G.K. Chesterton were, but there was a big Protestant apologetics movement. And as a result, you know, I had contemporary apologists in mind as models. You know, what's this guy doing right? What's this guy, what could he do better on? Things like that. I didn't need to look to the past for inspiration. I was just now doing it in a new Catholic context.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, fascinating. And congratulations on 30 years, Jimmy. 30 years here at Catholic Answers.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
To another 30.
Amen. To another 30. Okay, all the questions are coming from the internet. You didn't get any, like you said, the internet wasn't a thing when you started here, but now lots and lots of our interactions, including this right now, many people are joining us via the internet. And so we get questions from the internet, and we'll start with Joe's question. Joe asks this: if we are not guilty for the sins of our fathers, then why are we guilty of original sin? And he has a follow-up question. If Mary could be born without the stain of original sin, then why can't God afford us the same and let us all start off with a clean slate? And he says, thank you, Jimmy.
So we've got a problem in the term original sin because it comes across as misleading. When we use the word sin in English, at least in contemporary English, it means something that you have personally done wrong and that you are therefore personally responsible for. And that is not what original sin is. In fact, the Catechism goes out of its way to point out that original sin is not a personal fault. So at least given how the word sin is used in contemporary English, we're using it in only an accommodated way when we talk about original sin. What original sin is, and that's the reason that that we have original sin, even though we're not personally responsible for the sins of our fathers. So if my father, let's say he recklessly drove and ran somebody over, which thanks be to God, my father never did, but yeah, let's suppose he did. I'm not responsible for the fact he ran somebody over. He did that, not me. So I'm not responsible. And as a result, the way we have original sin is because of what it is. And notice I'm saying have original sin rather than guilty of original sin, because guilty implies personal guilt, and original sin does not make you personally guilty.
Right.
What original sin is essentially a kind of spiritual birth defect. It's a defect, meaning something that has gone wrong, but it's spiritual in nature, it's rather than purely physical in nature. And so it's inherited, just like we could inherit other birth defects. For example, let's suppose I'm Homer Simpson and I go down to the nuclear plant and I'm playing irresponsibly with radioactive materials. Well, if I damage my genes, then my children may be born bright yellow with bulging eyes and enormous overbites. You know, my children might have birth defects because of what I've done. I've damaged my nature, and therefore, when I pass on my nature to my children, they may have a defect as a result. And that's essentially what happened with our entire species. Adam and Eve, our first parents, were in a state of original justice, so they had God's grace in their souls, and they had perfectly balanced natures. But then, when they committed sin, they lost that original justice or original righteousness, and it damaged their natures. And therefore, when they reproduced, they passed on that damaged nature to us. But the reason we have original sin, the reason we're born with it, is because of the defective nature that has been passed on to us. We're missing original justice, and we've got disordered desires and so forth. So that's why we have it, even though we're not personally guilty for our ancestors' sins. In terms of the follow-up question, well, God could do for us exactly what he did for Mary. It's not a question of possibility. It is possible for God to render us all totally free of original sin and its consequences, and thus make us immaculate. And he will one day do that. We're not gonna be sinning and spotty and messed up in heaven.
Right.
So he will, by the time we enter heaven, make us immaculate, just like Mary is immaculate. But he did it for her early in order to make her a more fitting mother for his son. So he didn't have to do it for Mary, but he chose to do it because it made her a more fitting mother. And that's why she gets the benefit early and we don't, because she's his mom and we're not.
Yeah, very good. Thank you very, very much, Joe, for that question. Appreciate it. We got lots more questions coming from the internet. It's an internet open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. More of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Experience the incredible story of the woman who Time magazine named the most influential Catholic woman in the United States. Born Rita Rizzo, the future mother Angelica grew up in a rough neighborhood in Canton, Ohio. Young Rita experienced abandonment, rejection, and heartache, but God touched her through a woman named Rhoda Wise. Encounter this amazing woman at the Mother Angelica Museum. Plan your visit today at motherangelicamuseum.com.
Hi, I'm Debbie Giorgiani. Adam Bly and I invite you to join us as we tackle the spirit world on EWTN Radio. Adam has assisted at thousands of solemn exorcisms and resolutions of hauntings. He also reaches out to educate people on the paranormal and the occult in our culture. Join us Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern for the spirit world on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, both hours today, and it's an internet open forum, which is always fun because we get lots of interesting questions. As a matter of fact, we get to be kind of selective in our questions, so you know you're getting good questions for Jimmy. So if you want to make a call, you have to call on another day. Today, it is all internet. I do want to invite you to come to our annual conference. It's coming up in September, the last full weekend of September each year. We do our annual apologetics conference. You can find out all about it at CatholicAnswersConference.com. If you use the promo code EARLY right now, you'll get $50 off your conference ticket at CatholicAnswersConference.com. Scott Hahn going to be one of the speakers. Our keynote speaker is Sister Regina Marie Gorman, and we're talking about God. It is an entire conference dedicated to, thinking about how to defend, I suppose was one way to say it, the existence of God and the attributes of God in a world that has become increasingly distance from God. So very timely and helpful. We'd love to see you there. CatholicAnswersConference.com. All right. As I said, all the questions coming from the internet. This one comes from Dominic. You may have dealt with this before. Would aliens need baptism?
So, Cy Kellett, what's your guess? Have I dealt with this before?
I think personally, I've probably went with you 10 or 15 times when you've dealt with this.
Yeah.
And that's just the last 6 years.
It's a fairly simple answer. So, under certain conditions, yeah, they would need baptism. Condition number one, they would need to be fallen or otherwise able to benefit. Well, I can divide it up this way. Number one, typically they would need to be fallen. Number two, typically they would have no other means of redemption. And number three, if they could be redeemed in this way. And if those three conditions, or a fourth, alternately, if they would benefit from baptism, even if they're not fallen, you know, by being, say, a member of the mystical body of Christ with humans, mm-hmm. then they would need baptism. So either they're sinners like us who can benefit from baptism, or they're not sinners but could still benefit from baptism. Then they would need baptism for those purposes. If, on the other hand, if those conditions don't apply, if they wouldn't benefit from it, and especially if they're not sinners or it wouldn't help them, then they would not need baptism.
Dominic, I thank you for the question. I'm sure that is not the last time Jimmy will answer that, because it brings together two things Jimmy's famous for: Catholic faith and aliens.
So, also, for more on aliens and their relationship to the Christian faith, check out episode 55 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World at mysterious.fm/55.
Thanks again, Dominic. All right, this one comes from a priest. Father Matthew Schneider asks us this. We've had questions from him before. Mm-hmm. This one, clearly, he's some kind of deep-thinking Thomist, because he wants to know, how much wood could a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood?
Yeah, now you partially defeat the purpose if you break it up like that and say it in slowly and in chunks. You're supposed to do it quick. How much wood could a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood?
I know my limits, Jimmy. I know my limits.
Okay, so when I post calls for questions, you know, a lot of people ask questions that they're really wanting me to answer, and then some people occasionally put in smart aleck questions, which I then have to weed out. You know,
right,
so
right.
Effectively, when you put in a smart aleck question, you're wasting my time, because I just have to undo your work and to get the real question list that we need for the show. So I prefer it if people don't ask smart aleck questions. So I'm sure Father Matthew would never ask a smart aleck question and would never want to waste my time. So therefore, I will give him a straight answer. I assume he wants it. He asked it. I treat everybody's question seriously, except when I don't. And tautologically, there is a very good answer to this. It is a tautological answer, but the answer is as much wood as a woodchuck could chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood.
That was pretty good, Jimmy. That was pretty good. You did that fast. All right, Father.
Thank you.
I hope that that helps you. I don't. Is a woodchuck that little animal like a squirrel? Is that?
It's bigger than a squirrel, but it is. It is a mammal, and it has big teeth.
Thanks, Father Matthew. This one comes from Marita. What was God's plan if Adam and Eve? I was like that one. What was God's plan if Adam and Eve did not sin? What does original justice really mean when we say Adam and Eve were not supposed to die? What death are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about primarily physical death, because that's what's envisioned in overtly in Genesis is physical death. You know, Adam and Eve commit the sin, and therefore they're denied access to the tree of life, and without access to the tree of life, they end up dying. And that's what they were warned would happen. You also, if you conceptualize sin as a form of spiritual death, well, then they also experienced that. But God had mercy on them, and so they seem to have returned from that state of spiritual death. In terms of what original justice meant for Adam and Eve, well, if they had, I mean, it means that they had sanctifying grace. So they had God's grace in their soul. They were in a state of spiritual union with God. They also presumably did not have disordered desires prior to the fall. And there is various theological speculation that they may have had what we would call superpowers. Now, this is not church teaching, but you will have, you know, people like Thomas Aquinas saying that their bodies, for example, would have had the quality of agility, which would be a preternatural gift that would basically amount to teleportation. So if Adam wanted to be on the moon, just in a flash, he would be on the moon. Now, I'm skeptical of that. I don't know that these arguments are particularly well-grounded in the superpower area. However, there have been Catholic parapsychologists who have speculated that what psychic powers are the remnants of abilities that God put into human nature that we had better control of before the fall. So so whereas for Adam and Eve, they may have had precognition or telepathy or clairvoyance or something like, or psychokinesis in a way they could control and use in a useful way, but following the fall, such abilities no longer work reliably for us. And that was the view, for example, of the 20th century parapsychologist Father Alois Weisinger, and also Father Herbert Thurston, who were, as I said, a couple of Catholic parapsychologists. They both lived in the 20th century. So that's a possibility. Now, in terms of what would have happened, if they had not sinned? Well, they would have continued in that state of original justice. And according to many theologians, they eventually would have been confirmed in that state. So the idea is God gave them a period of probation where they could make a choice either way. And if they consistently had chosen good during their period of probation, they eventually would have become confirmed in good, just like we'll be confirmed in good in heaven. And so there is the proposal that that would have happened to them as well. Also, they would have retained access to the tree of life, and therefore they would have been able to eat from the tree of life, presumably on an ongoing basis, and avoid physical death.
Thank you very, very much, Marita, for that question. Appreciate it. It's Internet Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and this one comes from Steve. Suppose someone was alone in the woods and knew he was transforming into a zombie or a cordyceps zombie, which I assume Jimmy will explain to me. And if his zombified self made it back to civilization, it could be a disaster for the species. Could it be morally licit for him to end his own life to prevent this?
Okay, so good news, in real life, cordyceps are not harmful to humans. Cordyceps are a kind of fungus. In fact, in humans, they're used in traditional Chinese medicine for perceived health benefits. Whether they really have health benefits, I don't know. I've never used cordyceps. I've never done any testing or research about them. But this fungus is not really gonna hurt a human. However, it does eat insects from the inside out. So it is harmful to various insects. And hypothetically, a kind of cordyceps that, you know, would zombify a human could evolve. But good news is we're not there yet. So you don't got to worry too much about cordyceps. But setting that aside, so let's suppose you become infected with a zombie pathogen, whether it's cordyceps or something else, and you're in the woods and you know that if you make it back to civilization, it'll be a disaster for the species. Would it be morally licit to kill yourself in order to stop the threat? Well, killing yourself would be suicide, and suicide is always wrong. So you couldn't kill yourself, but you could do something else. You could kill the cordyceps. You could kill the zombie pathogen. Oh. You could stop the zombie pathogen from using your body to move toward human civilization. And that might mean you're going to die as a result, you know. But in this case, you're not killing yourself. You're killing or immobilizing the pathogen. And if you die as a result, okay, it's not suicide. You're not killing yourself. You're going to die as a result. But the target of what you're killing is the pathogen, not you. And therefore, you're not guilty of suicide. You're accepting your death as a foreseen consequence of another action that has a legitimate purpose. It's like if you're in a foxhole in World War I, and someone throws a hand grenade into your foxhole, and it's going to kill everybody in the foxhole unless you jump on it and cover it with your body, you can jump on it. Now, that's almost certainly going to kill you, but it will save the lives of everybody else. And it's not suicide because your goal is not to kill yourself. Your goal is to stop that grenade from going off. You just and killing everybody. You just die as a result. And in the same way, if you're stopping the cordyceps and it happens to kill you as a side effect, your goal is not to kill yourself. Your goal is to stop that cordyceps. And you just like you, the goal of stopping the grenade from killing everybody, your goal is to stop the cordyceps from killing everybody or zombifying everybody. And so it would be legitimate to undertake lethal action in regard to the cordyceps, even if the lethal effect will also kill you. So, news you can use.
I hope you won't be using it, Stephen. That would be very bad news for all the rest of us. But a fascinating moral calculation, because it's so easy to see when you see the falling on the grenade thing. Well, that's heroic. But you can if you're carrying a disease that I don't know what it I guess t- turning everyone into a zombie is pretty much the end of the human race. You can kill the disease.
It's definitely a bump.
Yeah, that would be. Yeah, there's probably, you know what? That might be one of those little evolutionary bumps where now the people who survive will be immune to this thing.
That could be.
And then we go on stronger as a species. In any case, Steve, don't bring the cordyceps near me. I don't want. So is there some kind of, there's a TV show or something about these cordyceps ones? I think I read about this.
It's been a while. I'm not familiar with the details, but like there's a TV show or game where cordyceps is the pathogen.
Oh, gotcha. All right, Stephen, thank you very much. Lots more great questions coming up because it's an internet open forum. All the questions for Jimmy Akin in this open forum today coming from the internet. So sit back, relax, and enjoy it. We'll be right back with more of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live. This year, the Catholic Answers Conference turns its attention to the question of God in an age of unbelief. Join us September 21st through 24th in San Diego for I Believe in God, featuring very special guest Scott Hahn and an all-star lineup of speakers. Spend four fun days with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. Seats are still available, but going fast. Use promo code EARLY to save $50 and register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, Jimmy Akin, our guest for this internet open forum. All the questions coming from the internet. Jimmy, of course, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which you can find at mysterious.fm. And I like saying that because I don't usually remember websites, and this one I've got memorized, mysterious.fm. Check it out. It's one of the very, very popular corners of the internet these days. Very popular documentary podcasts and all kinds of cool mysteries for you to explore over there. Our next question from the internet. Oh, go ahead.
So do you want to know what's coming out tomorrow?
I was anxious about whether I should ask. I didn't know whether I thought I...
You can always ask. If I know the date a pre-record is airing, I can tell you what's happening. Yeah.
So tomorrow, June 2nd, tomorrow from today is June 2nd. What would it be, Jimmy?
Well, so the previous Friday, last week, we told you a very interesting story about, it's called The 21st Century Poltergeist. And it's about a little boy who began displaying poltergeist effects on all of the electronic devices that we have around us in the 20th century. So instead of just moving objects, according to the reports, he was interfering with the electrical function of all kinds of different devices. So you can check out last week's episode, which is already out, and hear about the 21st century poltergeist. In terms of what's coming out tomorrow, it's a patron's question show, and we're going to be answering questions like whether you can be possessed by an angel, We're going to talk about the hollow moon theory, the Genesis flood, and the Younger Dryas flooding, whether there are two Marys in the raising of Lazarus account, how we got the chapters and verses of the Bible, the Aramaic of the Lord's Prayer, the Philadelphia experiment, Ouija boards, King Arthur, the Nation of Islam, and more.
Boy, that is a cornucopia of good stuff tomorrow. The poltergeist kid is scary. He can't send you to the cornfield, can he?
He cannot.
Okay.
Even if you're a bad man, he can't do that.
That makes me nervous.
Even if you're a very bad man, he can't do that.
That kid was too good an actor. That
was Billy Mumy.
Oh yeah, did he go on to do Lost in Space?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And Babylon 5.
Yeah. Well.
And Barnes and Barnes.
That still bothers me. Do you know what we're talking about, Darren? Do you have any idea what we're talking about? That's the old Twilight Zone. One of the scariest episodes. A kid who could send you into the cornfield with his mind.
It's a good life.
Is that the name of it?
Yeah.
Ryan asks this. Why is it that the Knox and Douay-Rheims Bible Old Testaments only feature 3rd and 4th Kings, but not other translation of the Old Testament in other Catholic Bibles?
Okay, so if you look in the Knox or the Douay-Rheims Old Testament, you'll see that it has these four books called 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 3 Kings, and 4 Kings. And if you look in most Bibles, you're only going to see that they have 1 and 2 Kings. But then you're going to see they got a couple extra books, 1 and 2 Samuel. And if you look back in your Knox or your Douay version, there's no 1 and 2 Samuel. So why do Knox and Douay have 3rd and 4th Kings, but not 1st and 2nd Samuel? And the answer is because they all have all the same books. They're just going by different names. Mm-hmm. So in most Bibles, you will see the sequence 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings. And the reason for that is because the books of Samuel deal with an early period and the beginning of Israel's monarchy. And then once you get into the kings, you're dealing with multiple kings. I mean, there actually is more than one king in 1 and 2 Samuel, but you get a whole slew of kings in 1 and 2 Kings. So that's why the first two books are called Samuel and the second two books are called Kings. In the first two books, you get a bunch about the prophet Samuel before the monarchy begins. And then in 1 and 2 Kings, you get a whole bunch of different kings. Now, but you do got kings in 1 and 2 Samuel. You've got Saul, you've got Saul's son, Ishbosheth, you've got David. And so, so there are some kings in there too. And as a result, when the Septuagint Greek Old Testament was being translated, they decided to call 1 and 2 Samuel 1 and 2 Kings. And that then made what we call 1 and 2 Kings 3 and 4 Kings. Mm-hmm. So the sequence 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings is the same books under different names in the sequence 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 3 Kings, 4 Kings. And then at the end of that sequence, you'll also have 1 and 2 Chronicles, which in some of these older Bibles will be called 1 and 2 Paralipomenon, but it's the same books. So they all have the same books. It's just that they sometimes go by different names. And after the Septuagint introduced the 1st to 4th Kings language, that got picked up by the Vulgate, and then the Douay is a translation of the Vulgate, and the Knox is another, you know, kind of retro translation, so it uses that same terminology as well.
Got it. Ryan, I hope that's helpful to you. I won't ask Jimmy it now, but I have a similar question about there used to be a movie called Star Wars, but now that movie doesn't exist anymore. There's a movie called Star Wars: A New Hope.
Episode 4, A New Hope.
Oh, Episode 4, A New Hope. Yeah. But there used to be a movie called Star Wars, but it just doesn't exist. Look it up. It doesn't exist anymore. Patrick wants to know this. When someone is canonized a saint, who decides what attributes will be associated with the images of the saint? St. Peter has his keys. St. Lucy has her eyes. If there is ever a St. Jimmy, how will your attributes be identified?
Okay, so as far as I know, there is not a central registry that determines this. If there were, it would be at least for most saints, it would be the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints in Rome. But as far as I know, they don't do this. They don't issue lists of, now that we have this new saint, here's what their attributes are going to be for visual depiction. I should explain what that is. I mean, Patrick does explain it, but it's traditional to depict saints with certain visual things. So even if you don't have a label telling you the name of the saint, you can still tell who the saint is. So Jesus gave Saint Peter the keys of the kingdom, so it's customary to depict Peter with keys. And so if you see a picture of a saint and he's got keys, he's probably Saint Peter. But as far as I know, there's not an official body that determines this. Is to the extent of my awareness, this is a folk process that is determined by artists and their patrons when they are making Christian art. And so whether it's Western art or icon writing, icon painting, it's really the artistic community that ends up deciding how to depict a particular saint in a distinctive way so you can recognize him visually. And so to my knowledge, that's how it's done. It's really a kind of a collective decision that gets made by artists. In terms of, if there were a Saint Jimmy, what would my visual attributes be? Well, it'd be up to the artists, but I would presume a long red beard would be one of them. Also a cowboy hat and possibly a pipe. So there's some suggestions for future artists if there ever were to be a St. Jimmy.
And possibly an alien looking over your shoulder.
Sure, why not?
Because one of the
Or things... I could be baptizing the alien.
Oh, that's right. Jimmy, famous for answering the question, will we baptize aliens? you never know what's going to last. That might be the thing that'll last. Thank you very much for your question. Appreciate that. That was Ryan. Was that Ryan? Yeah, no, that was Patrick. I apologize, Patrick. I don't know if I gave your name at the beginning of that one. It's time to take a break. As you can tell by my floundering around, we'll take that break. We'll be right back with more open forum, but it's an internet open forum for Jimmy Akin right after this.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
One time somebody said to me, why don't you air these people? And I said, no, because I don't think they're Catholic. He says, by what right do you have to say that? I said, I own the network.
Mother Angelica Live Classics, every morning, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. We're doing an internet open forum. We got lots and lots of questions from the internet. You can send them to us. If you're like, oh, I want to get in on that for next time, just shoot us an email over at radio@catholic.com. Radio@catholic.com. Either Edgar or I will find it there. One of us will find it, and we'll get it to Jimmy. All right, so this one comes from I was going to do Patrick again. This one comes from Jordana or Jordana. Is there anything in tradition as to why Pilate only offers to release either Jesus or Barabbas and not the two thieves crucified next to Jesus? Could they have been Gentiles?
Well, I'm not aware of anything in tradition. I mean, certainly there's nothing in an authoritative church tradition. This is not the kind of matter that really would be dealt with by that, because that deals with the substance of the faith, and it's not a matter of the faith what Pilate's motivations were. But in terms of lower T tradition, you know, there may have been some early authors who speculated on this, none of them early enough that they would be historically informed by, you know, someone in Pilate's circle as to what his motives were. And so really it would be conjecture on their part. And we can do conjecture today. In terms of why Jesus and Barabbas, well, because they were both notable prisoners. And the purpose behind Pilate releasing a prisoner is to earn favor with the local population. And so that's why you release political prisoners. And usually the political prisoners who get released are frequently the big famous ones. And so because you get more favor with the populace that way, if you give them someone who is famous and they all know about, then they're going to look at you more favorably than if you give them some nobody that nobody has ever heard of. And so if you're going to do this kind of political prisoner release, you're going to tend to release notorious people and people who are well known. And so Jesus was well known in the days leading up to his crucifixion, certainly in the days leading up to the crucifixion. Also, Barabbas was well known. We're even told in the Gospels that he was well known. Presumably, the other two criminals that were not released were not as well known as Barabbas. And in fact, Barabbas may have been their boss. This is where we get into some conjecture. We're told that Barabbas had been arrested in an uprising in the city. And so he was like a political rabble leader that had been, you know, he'd staged a riot of some kind. And we're also told that the other two criminals are lesthai, which lesthes in Greek. It's sometimes translated robber, but it also can be translated revolutionary, because back then, if you wanted to do a revolution, you usually had to rob people. And so robbers and revolutionaries were overlapping job descriptions. And so these other two, lesthai, were probably in the same rebellion that Barabbas was in. Barabbas may have been a ringleader in the rebellion, and the other two were just collaborators in the rebellion. And so in discerning what one prisoner am I going to release, he's going to go for one of the big dogs. He's going to go for Jesus or Barabbas, because they're the famous ones. They will earn him more public favor if he releases them. He's not going to release the little foot soldier followers in the rebellion.
Ah, very, very interesting. Okay, thanks very much. Appreciate that question, Jordana. Let's go to Eileen's question. Eileen asks, when detectives do undercover work, does that constitute lying, and could it be considered consequentialism?
It's going to depend on your definition of lying. Okay. If you define lying as the utterance with intent to deceive of any untruth, then yes, not only detectives, but also spies and other people like that lie constantly as part of their jobs. They use ruses, they use deception, and they say things with intent to deceive that are not true. They also do things with intent to deceive. And that's also in the catechism is lumped under the definition of lying as well. So it doesn't have to just be words. And it could or could not be considered consequentialism depending on your understanding of consequentialism. Now, when we do moral calculations, one of the things we need to take into account is the consequences. So just because consequences get appealed to though, does not make it consequentialism, because every sane theory of moral calculation includes consequences. You know, if I'm facing the question, do I drive to the supermarket? Well, okay, what are the odds of me hitting and killing somebody? Are they low enough? And the answer is almost always yes, but are they low enough that it's that I can reasonably go get what I want at the store and be morally blameless? On the other hand, if I'm got a cold and I'm taking cold medicine and it's making me woozy, well, the risk of hitting somebody on the way to the store might be high enough that I should let someone else go to the store or use DoorDash or something like that, rather than endanger someone because I'm doped up on cold medicine and it's making me woozy. So every sane theory of morals is going to include a look at the consequences. What distinguishes that from consequentialism is consequentialism says only the consequences are important, nothing else. And you aren't, just because you're telling untruths to someone with intent to deceive, you aren't saying the consequences of this are the only things that are important. I can imagine and have talked about theories of lying where you can include a look at the consequences, but it doesn't make it the consequences are the only important thing. For example, one of the ways that has occurred to me to conceptualize what lying does is it essentially damages another person's belief system by feeding false information into their belief system. And so it's a kind of damage. If you want to use a fancy philosophical term for it, it's a form of doxastic damage, meaning damage to beliefs. And so we can then ask the question, well, is it ever licit to do damage to someone? Can you ever punch anybody? And the answer is yes. For example, in self-defense or proxy self-defense, where you're saving somebody else's life, You can sock somebody. You can do physical damage to them. It's not your first resort, but it can be done if it's the only or best way to solve a situation. But does that mean any use of physical force is justified? Could I kill innocent people if it had good consequences? Well, no, you can't, because they're innocent people. So if you think in terms of use of physical violence, well, we got to consider the consequences of using it, and it's legitimate in some cases, like self-defense or defending someone else, but not all use of it is justified. And in the same way, I could see someone saying, okay, well, if lying is essentially damaging someone's belief system, then there could be situations where the damage is warranted. And I'll give an example in a moment, but that doesn't mean that it's warranted in all situations. For example, one thing I don't think you can deceive someone about is, are you a Christian? If you're called upon to acknowledge your Christian faith, you can't lie about that. You can't say, no, I'm not a Christian. Similarly, if someone asks, is Jesus the Son of God? It's intrinsically wrong to tell them he's not the Son of God. And so you can't lie about that. But I can see situations where damaging a person's belief system could be legitimate. And of course, one of the classic examples is the Nazis come to your door and want to know if you have Jews in your attic. Well, if I'm honest and I tell them, yes, I have Jews in my attic, if I don't try to deceive them, then it's going to result in the deaths of the Jews. It's going to result in my death probably, or I've got to kill these officers and it's going to result in their death. On the other hand, if I just say, nah, I don't got any Jews in my attic, look at my big Nazi flag, I'm with you guys, okay? then the I've damaged their belief system by making them think I'm a Nazi when I'm not. But I've saved the Jewish lives, I've saved my life, and I've saved their lives. And so I think that that's a situation where it, on this theory of lying, lying is potentially justified. Not everybody agrees with that. Some people have a different theory of lying. They say it can never be justified under any circumstances, in which case you either have to say what detectives and spies do is always wrong, or you got to come up with some kind of exception for why what they're doing is not really lying. And I've talked to some people of this persuasion and said, okay, so so can they do this? And they'll say, can they use tactical deception? They'll say, oh, yes. Well, how is that not lying that's not permitted by your view? And they'll just say, well, it's just not. And I have been unsatisfied with that answer. It's personally, I'm inclined towards the damage theory of lying, where you can, where lying is a form of intellectual violence, and violence can be used in some but not all circumstances. So that's how I would tend to answer that.
Thank you so much for that question, Eileen. So the commandment, thou shalt not give false witness, that refers to a very specific kind of lying then?
Well, it, properly speaking, yeah, it refers to lying in court. And so you shall not give false testimony in court. It represents a principle that's broader than that. We shouldn't be ordinarily lying to each other in society either, because that's going to cause problems. You need society to basically run on trust. And in order for it to run on trust, you need truthfulness. So you have a general need for truth telling in broader society that goes beyond merely what the commandment would formally require, which is truth telling in court.
Right, but you would like if you lied about someone in court, you're definitely breaking that. That would be, in other words,
yes,
the absolute, the kind of literal,
yeah,
baseline would be you cannot go into court and say, and which, I mean, that seems very, very basic. You're that's a terrible injustice to commit,
right,
against
you
someone.
You would be a false witness against your neighbor, and therefore you would be breaking the commandment in the most literal sense.
I'm not giving out the phone number today because it's an internet open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy celebrating 30 years today at Catholic Answers. Today is the 30th anniversary of Jimmy's report to work day here at Catholic Answers. It's an extraordinary 30 years, 25 of it here, well, 25 and a half now on the air here at Catholic Answers Live. An extraordinary record, and we're going to continue when we come back with more internet open forum questions. These, as Jimmy said before, there was no internet when he started here, but now a great deal of our work is done via the internet. And one of the ways you can use that internet is, if you'd like, we'd love you to come to Rome with us coming up in November of this year. And on November 9th, the flannel panel that you hear sometimes here on Catholic Answers Live is heading to Rome, and you can join us on that pilgrimage just by going to CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com. It's going to be a true pilgrimage. We will visit the Vatican. We will do our very best. As of right now, we fully intend to go into to do the Scavi tour underneath, where you can see the bones of St. Peter, and you can pray there. By the bones of St. Peter, you can see all the little crypts that are underneath what is now the St. Peter's Basilica, the great basilica of the Catholic Church. But plus, we'll be visiting all kinds of things that you might not otherwise visit, sites that might not come up on a more secular tour of Rome.
Should go to the Tarpeian Rock.
Oh, we should go to the Tarpeian Rock, but looking from the bottom up, not the top down. That's where they used to throw you off if they got really mad at you.
I know. I love in the 12 tables of Roman law, you'll occasionally have this death sentence. If someone does X, let him be hurled from the Tarpeian Rock.
Just throw you off the rock. That's how they did it in those days. So if you want to join us on the pilgrimage, go to CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com. CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com. There are still spots available, but we're only taking 50 with us. That's so that we can all stay on the same bus together. And we'll be staying right down by the Forum at the Forum Hotel right downtown in Rome. Coming back, once again, go to CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com if you want to join us. Coming back with a whole hour more of Open Forum, Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin continues right after this on Catholic Answers Live.